My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagritz, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about what the European Union needs to do now, right? After the emergency episode that we recorded just 2 days ago and that we already published very quickly, right, on that meeting, that infamous meeting by now in the White House, in the Oval Office between Trump and Zelensky, where it seems like the transatlantic alliance has come to an end. Boulder, we're today doing something we haven't done in a long time, and that's giving some steps on what to do now, almost giving solutions.
Yeah, that is not like us, Dario. We are always the ones who criticize and don't actually come up with the answers. But right now, this is such a watershed moment. And when you say the EU, it's not just the EU, it's just European countries in general, right? This is such a watershed moment for Europe where it is should be completely clear to anyone watching that the transatlantic alliance is no longer. There is still a good relationship between Europe and the United States. Hopefully that will continue forever. But the transatlantic alliance in the way that it was envisioned during the Cold War simply does not exist. And that means that Europe now has to embrace that and use that to its advantage. And it makes sense right now to then think, okay, what does that actually mean in terms of practical steps? Also, because that's what I'm talking about with clients and people around me.
Well, maybe this is the first question we actually have to answer, because here on our document, it says EU. You've just said Europe. Who are we talking about now? Are we talking about the EU 27, right? So the European, like the member countries of the European Union. Are we talking about a wider Europe, including Norway, Switzerland, the United Kingdom?
My answer to that would be yes, in the sense that everyone and no one in the we do not. It depends a little bit on who is willing to be part of this, right? The European Union is a extremely useful tool, but it still doesn't have the power, the influence to set these really, really big agenda points. It doesn't have the power to actually tell countries you have to unify your army or you have to form a united front. And so the moment that you then start looking at individual countries, as always, first France and Germany, Paris and Berlin, then it becomes a question of who else wants to join. And you could even imagine easily a world in which this also includes the United Kingdom. Switzerland will stay out of it. But any European country that somehow sees value in the European identity being protected from geopolitical forces. That's what we're talking about. And if the EU could lead that, amazing, but it shouldn't be exclusively the European Union because they simply aren't there yet.
Also, we're not including Russia and Belarus.
Hey, if Russia and Belarus want to join. By the way, you say that you know, in an ironic tone, but it is kind of weird how throughout history we have excluded Russia from the European conversation, right? Of course, right now that would be impossible because the whole point is this is all centering around Ukraine. But this is simply about how does Europe want to position itself towards the rest of the world going forward in the next 50, 60 years beyond Ukraine, beyond Donald Trump. There should always be a space for Russia to somehow connect to that, because Russia is and has always been a very important European nation.
So from now on, when we talk about Europe, we're talking about a potential coalition of the willing. Whoever wants to be part of this can be part of it.
Yeah, and one where Europe can manage its own affairs in a increasingly anarchical world. Now, right now there are some practical issues that will take precedence, first and foremost Ukraine and Trump, but 10, 20, 30 years down the line, this question will still be valid. And now is the time that leaders need to lay the foundations for that long-term vision.
Looking at the steps, I mean, the first out of these 9 steps is basically changing mentality and also aligning, right? Because in our last episode, we said that about 50% of European leaders, right, and within the leadership are are still somewhat hesitant to agree that this is the new reality, and they're kind of talking about, oh, well, maybe let's even appease Trump, we can spend more on the military, we'll take down some tariffs. And then there's the other half that's very much has realized the new reality that we live in.
Yeah, so at the moment it seems that almost everyone agrees that there needs to be a shift towards defense spending. But the reasons for that shift are exactly, as you say, are divided. And so Trump has always been pushing for greater defense spending and demanding that as a condition to continue being part of NATO. And others are saying, actually, it is the opposite. It's not because we want to please Trump, but because we need to now become independent from Trump. We need to become independent from these NATO structures, these American-led structures, because it's simply no longer a reliable ally in the way that it used to be. And that's certainly the camp that I'm in. The people who still try to appease Trump are making a huge long-term mistake. Not because Trump will be there forever, but because Trump symbolizes a process that has been going on for a long time, namely that the United States is now just another geopolitical player and Europe needs to identify itself as, as a potential partner, as a potential ally, but not as beholden to that geopolitical player.
You and the listeners know that I always need to put things into examples and compare them, despite sometimes comparisons not making a lot of sense. But if I had to describe the new relationship between Europe and the United States, it would be similar to Europe and India, right? That we are, hey, we're somewhat aligned on a few issues. We have friendly relationships. We consider each other friendly nations. But that's about it.
Yeah, the problem with comparisons is that they always fall apart once you start looking at details, because there is no doubt that Europe and North America have a shared history and a shared culture that is different from, for example, India. But at a geopolitical level, that's exactly it. Like, Europe needs to position itself as a continent that says to everyone around them, we have learned from our colonial mistakes. We have learned from the past 300-400 years. We understand that we no longer have the power that we used to have, and that requires an internal realignment. And we are now happy to do business with the United States or with India or with China or anyone who is a productive, constructive partner. And we are no longer going to be part of these geopolitical fights. We're no longer going to be part of this engine trying to promote liberal democracy around the world. We want friendly relations with everyone. And the first country that we want friendly relations with is the United States. But we're no longer going to have this emotional dependence on them.
But what you just said is wishful Western bubble podcast thinking, right? Because I actually think the reality is that Europe now sees itself as, okay, we are an independent geopolitical actor that is the last one left to promote liberal democratic institutions and values over the world, because the United States no longer sees itself in that position. And it to me, at least, following the rhetoric of leaders, the tone that kind of is around me here, particularly in Berlin, seems to be, well, now we're the last ones left. Now we have to be the defenders of democracy.
Yeah, the problem is that they have to explain what they mean in practical terms. So I'm all for liberal democracy, as we've said over and over again in this podcast. But Europe can do that by being an example of good liberal democracy. Let's work at home. We've got plenty of work to do. German elections have just happened. There's plenty of work to do to make sure that Europe remains a healthy liberal democracy, or at least a continent full of healthy liberal democracies. Focus on ourselves, and if we manage to make that a success, then the rest of the world might actually look at us and say, hey, you know what, we would like to emulate that. But stop this aggressive approach towards the rest of the world, because it hinders your actual aim, it hinders your objectives, right? And it makes it much, much harder to do business with the rest of the world. If Europe actually wants to connect with China, they cannot continue on this old path. It's just not going to work.
See, another crazy comparison coming here, but as I'm the voice of the youth here in this podcast, I'm going to make it. This to me feels a little bit like a bad breakup, right? Where Europe has been in a relationship with the United States. There was always some kind of emotional dependence on it, also maybe some material dependence. Now the United States has kind of been this, you know, this uncomfortable, somewhat toxic man. There's now this breakup. And now, because the way you said it, right, that Europe now needs to focus on itself, get its act together, it almost feels like in a few months we need to get a new haircut, we need to go to the gym, start working out, and then we can maybe start looking for a new partner.
That's exactly it. That's exactly what Europe needs to do. Basically, now that you're out of this kind of over-dependence on the United States, you're out of this relationship, you're out of this toxic marriage that used to be good one day, right? In the Cold War, it really worked very well. And credit where credit is due. NATO, in that sense, had a real function to play, but that is decades ago. Slowly, toxicity has set in. Slowly, you drift apart. And now that it becomes clear that the divorce needs to happen, it hasn't really been formalized yet, but it needs to be formalized, then it is about finding yourself again in therapeutic terms and connecting then hopefully with your ex-partner in a healthy, productive way where you can still share the kids. You know, you can still you can still meet each other and have a coffee once in a while and talk about the good old days and see where you still have aligned interests. It would not be in Europe's interest to antagonize the United States unnecessarily. It is just important that it looks at the United States as no longer the one who sets the agenda for them.
Well, and that's the second step, right? Stop trying to please the United States, particularly Trump. Not increasing your defense spending to be in line with what he demands, but to increase your defense spending as part of, right, to stay with the analogy, as your new gym membership.
Yeah, so if we're going down this as a manifesto, think of the US differently, break up with them emotionally, then stop trying to please them. It's interesting, by the way, that this is the very first time in my career that I'm actually advocating defense spending, right? I've been always very skeptical. We'll get to that a little bit later in more detail, but it shows what an important moment that is to say we need to redefine ourselves. We need to say we need to have a clear image of who we are, and surely anyone looking in a mirror will not want to appease bullies. And even though the United States as a nation should and can still be a very friendly nation to Europe and vice versa, it's clear that Trump is currently bullying the world. And if Europe has a long-term vision of being a beacon of, if you like, reasonable prosperity and reasonable connections around the world, giving in to Trump, trying to sort of walk on eggshells, trying to not anger Trump, would be absolutely the wrong thing to do. If a bully bullies you, you have to retaliate until he stops bullying you, and then you can do business again.
And the next step is to form a support group with those who have been bullied by Trump as well. That is, you have Mexico and Canada who are currently being heavily, heavily targeted by Trump. And this would, right, we already spoke about this a few weeks ago, we could offer EU membership to Canada.
Yeah, I've read about that. That's not going to happen anytime soon for a million reasons, but getting a closer relation with building up some kind of deeper connection with Canada, with Mexico, but lots of other countries around the world as well that are now left behind by the Trump administration is actually a very healthy thing to do, exactly because of that vision of Europe being the reasonable middle ground in a world full of anarchical geopolitical tensions, right? Europe can play that game. They can turn their dark colonial history into an advantage, saying, hey, we've learned from our past and now we can connect to you in a different way. We are aware that we did some really bad stuff, but we've grown up, we've matured, and now we can help you stand up against that bully from Washington. And as a result, you're going to be stronger, we're going to be stronger, and hopefully that bully at some point will reform himself, or if you like, will be kicked out of the White House and be replaced with a different identity.
Well, is that something? Because my concern is, What if we disconnect from the United States now? We also, right, we do step four, we disconnect from NATO. And but what if he changes? What if Trump is gone in 4 years? And then there's Pete Buttigieg, right, of the Democrats becomes the newest president, and he's good looking and he's nice to Europe again. And should we really burn all bridges?
You know, the answer is absolutely no. We shouldn't burn any bridges in itself, except for the bridge that automatically connects our identity, the marriage, if you like. We have to divorce. But from that moment on, we should keep all the bridges stable and open for business. Even before Buttigieg comes into power, even with Trump himself. We know that Trump is volatile. Trump can change depending on how the wind blows, right? It seems to me, from an American perspective, that he's horribly overplaying his hand at the moment. And I wouldn't be surprised that if in the next 1 or 2 years he starts toning it down and he starts using a different kind of rhetoric. That would be similar to what happened in the first presidency, except that now he is, you know, wilder and more unleashed than before. We should always, always be open to good relations with the United States. Obviously, Europe wants to connect to the United States. But there is a substantial difference between Europe saying, United States, we need you because otherwise we are weak and vulnerable, and it's a scary world out there, or saying to the United States, hey, United States, just like with all those other geopolitical powers and smaller nations around the world, we would love to do business with you, and we appreciate you for who you are, and let's work together, but only on equal terms, not on terms of dependency.
Mm. And so part of this is disconnecting from NATO, step four.
Disconnecting from NATO, it has to happen at some point. I cannot repeat enough how Macron in 2017, was right when he said NATO is brain dead. Then Ukraine happens and all of a sudden NATO has this new step, this spring in its step. It feels that it is that it has legitimacy again. We've discussed this quite a lot during the podcast. But the long-term dynamics were always going to go to this point. They were always moving towards a place where at some point NATO didn't make sense anymore. Now, after this past whirlwind of Trump measures, it should be completely obvious to any European leader that NATO cannot be the long-term solution. That we have to create a defense structure that lies outside of NATO, that is not dependent on the big elephant in the room, namely the United States, because without the United States, NATO is nothing. NATO has both from a moral perspective as well as from a practical perspective lost legitimacy. Now, this is not easy because there is no other transnational organization in the world as efficient as NATO. NATO is an incredibly well-operated, well-designed organization. And for 80 years, these countries have integrated into that organization. So this is a very, very messy divorce, to put it in those terms, right? It will take a long time. It will create some pain. There's going to be resistance from NATO itself, but also just from armed forces in Europe that are so integrated into these structures. It's not an easy thing to do, but it needs to happen.
And right, so the like steps, the important steps when it comes to disconnecting from NATO is basically 5 and 6 that we've outlined. So it's stop your military dependence on US systems, which is particularly painful when it comes to intelligence. Right, US intelligence is simply the best in the world. And that's also the really painful thing for Ukraine right now, that Ukraine is no longer receiving US intelligence support, and that the European countries cannot kind of fill that gap. So that's kind of the first step. And then the next one is you need to, once you stopped your dependence on the US military systems, you need to develop your autonomous military industry and systems.
Yeah. There's no problem if the Europe buys some shells from the United States, some ammunition and all of that, that's fine because that's easily replaced. But right now the situation is that a lot of the high-tech, most sophisticated systems, including within the Air Force, within the Navy, are all essentially integrated into the United States Armed Forces. And that needs to stop, right? So it's not breaking all military connections with the United States, but Europe needs to be able to operate even if the United States says we are not going to help you. Even if in a theoretical scenario, and that is not any practical, realistic thing that would happen anytime soon, but even in situation where the United States might actively choose a side against Europe. And though we cannot continue a place where they just have to pull some switches and all of a sudden things don't work in Europe anymore. It's just not the way to go forward. By the way, I should point out that obviously we're doing this from a European perspective, not so much because you and I are Europeans, but mostly because it is time for Europe to take this position, right? An American analyst should probably say the same about Europe. It just doesn't make sense anymore to have this deeply integrated military that is completely dependent on the whims of the White House.
Well, maybe we can talk about this from a US perspective next week, how to do this breakup in a non-messy way from a US Western bubble perspective.
Indeed. Yeah, that would be a useful conversation to have. Ignoring then the fact that right now the volatility in the White House means that proper planning cannot happen. But Europeans can engage in proper planning, and they should use that at the moment.
Well, that's what I'm really, I know that this needs to happen, but what I'm really concerned about is that all these working level relationships that it took 80 years to build, right, on all levels. So on intelligence gathering, intelligence sharing, on the military collaborations, right, under the NATO umbrella. I was always so surprised talking to anyone from the military of how fond they are of each other, right? The particularly US, because here I'm in Germany, right? And I would mostly talk to US and German military personnel. They were always so happy with each other. They were always so glad. Oh, we love working with the Germans. Oh, of course, without the United States, we wouldn't be anything, right? And it's so sad to see that these working relationships that are working in sync, as you said, right? NATO is a really good organization. That they now have to be broken up because that part still within the Western bubble framework, right? So criticizing the strategic level, but that part worked so well. And it breaks my heart to see that we now kind of need to break this apart because there were some really good elements of this marriage.
And this is a marriage that started from a good place, right? I mean, at least a Cold War place where it seemed to make perfect sense. The West wanted to be protected from the Soviet Union. They were very concerned about what they saw in Eastern Europe. And the United States generously, also strategically in their own interest, not just because they were good human beings, but also because they strategically wanted to contain the Soviet Union, generously offered assistance to Europe. And they did so really generously, as in Europe was also received a Marshall Plan, received a lot of benefits. And so the early phase, the honeymoon phase of this marriage was very, very positive. And out of that grew this incredibly well-operated machine. And it is completely understandable that many, many leaders, including many academics, many intellectuals, are still emotionally completely beholden to this, to NATO and the Transatlantic Alliance. Anyone who is my age and older will have this emotional kind of connection because we remember what it was like to be afraid of the Soviet Union.
I didn't have the fear of the Soviet Union, but even I have this emotional connection, right? I mean, I was still that student generation where in high school of like if you wanted to gain some first or right exchange experience, you would go to the United States. And I think I was actually one of the last last classes basically to go and really enjoy it because I remember on one of my last days in the United States before I left back to Germany after staying there for a year, that was the day when Trump went down the escalator in the Trump Tower and announced his bid for presidency. Right? It's not only on that. I assume for your generation it's very much this fear level, right, of the Cold War and kind of this relationship you've built. But for us, at least for my generation, I can say that. That there was, of course, always this deep desire to go to the US and kind of experience US culture. I think now it has actually shifted. It's a little bit the other way around, where now Europeans no longer want to go to the United States, already for a few years now. But a lot of American students, particularly on the university level, want to come to Europe to experience what it's like to live in a somewhat normal system where things are not so overly Americanized.
Yeah, and this is where the analogy with, for example, India falls apart, right? Because this connection between Europe and the United States goes way beyond defensive measures, goes way beyond geopolitics, and has to do with deep cultural connections that are actually very hard to artificially create. They come from history, from the fact that the United States was born out of European roots. India was not born out of European roots. I mean, geopolitically it was, but culturally and historically it wasn't. And so we should never ever deny this deep connection between the two. It's not a matter of saying bye to the United States. It's a matter of redefining our relationship, and we absolutely need to do that. But it is very difficult. And also, you're speaking to a Dutch person, right? The Netherlands is a country that has always identified itself as that bridge between the Anglo-Saxon world, the UK and the United States, and continental Europe. It's not coincidental that the Netherlands has had multiple secretary generals of NATO, because the United States trusts the Netherlands, because it knows that the Netherlands is this place that will always support its geopolitical ambitions. And so for the Dutch government and the Dutch military, this is even harder than for the Germans or for the French or anyone else, right? It requires a really deep therapeutic process of thinking about who you want to be in the long term and what is it that you think the world is going to look like.
This is why, I mean, points 4, 5, and 6, so start disconnecting from NATO, stop military dependence on the US systems, develop autonomous military industry, right? That's why these points are somewhat hurting. I mean, because I emotionally, also for me, it's just hurting to have to, like, for Europe to have to disconnect from the United States. But then point 7, the next one, does make a lot of sense. And that's something that I remember I've been thinking about for as long as I've been thinking about international relations. And that is that there needs to be some form of, right, integrated, synergized systems between European armed forces, or even a European armed force, or however you would want to call that. Because, I mean, for me, the main reason is that it would just be a lot cheaper.
Well, it would be
in the long run
cheaper, but more than anything, it is the only way that you can actually use your military as a deterrent, right? The point of a military in the 21st century is to make sure that nobody is even thinking about militarily attacking you, right? It's becoming a world where the international rules no longer apply, international law is falling apart in front of our eyes, the UN no longer has any serious power. So you need a deterrence that says to anyone from the outside, do not even think about it. And that can only happen when European armed forces integrate. Because the moment you have separate islands, the outside might think, well, actually, we could break them apart, right? We could divide and conquer. We can invade Poland because Germany and France will not automatically react. And that is exactly why you need that integration, to have an automatic, direct reaction to anyone who wants to challenge you. And this is where, for me, this is kind of a big thing personally, that I have never ever advocated for increased defense spending, because it used to be stupid. We have enough tanks, we have enough planes, we have enough nuclear weapons. There is no way that Russia or anyone else could attack European Union countries. The problem is, right now, not that we need more military equipment, but we need different military systems that are outside of NATO. And that costs a lot of money. And that's why we have to increase our defense budgets for a certain period of time, until this European integration has been established. It is not about building up more forces. It's about building independent, better reaction mechanisms against anyone who might want to threaten Europe and no longer ever be dependent on the United States.
Well, as you said, right, the military in the 21st century is about deterrence. The crown jewel of deterrence are nuclear weapons, is a nuclear shield. Within Europe, there's only two countries that have, that I know of at least, right? Because, hey, if Iran has been this close to developing a nuclear weapon, I don't know how close other countries may have been. But jokes aside, so it's only France and the United Kingdom that have nuclear weapons. And that's a conversation that flares up in Germany once in a while. Over the last 8 years, basically every time Trump took office or said something, there was a discussion, should France offer its nuclear shield to all of Europe? How would we pay for that? How would that work? I think the UK, we can kind of take out of this discussion, but there would have to be a discussion about a nuclear shield for European, or in this case very specifically EU countries, because European countries might be difficult.
Absolutely. There is one interesting note that goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of this episode. You conveniently forget a third country in Europe that has nuclear weapons. Its capital is
Russia.
Moscow.
Oh, yeah.
Once again, we think of Europe as if Russia is not part of it, right? I mean, Russia is very much a European country, and it has 5,000 nuclear warheads. Yeah.
But do you think they would be willing to give some of them to us?
Yeah, let's share the Russian shield, nuclear shield. Yeah, that would work. You're absolutely right what you're saying about the UK. And in some ways, and this has been kind of murmured in Brussels lately quite a bit, it is an advantage that the UK has left the EU, that Brexit happened in that sense, because everything we're saying about the difficult breakup between the EU and the United States is doubly so in the case of London, in the case of the United Kingdom with the US. Trident, armed forces, submarines, everything in the UK is so, so connected to the United States that is a completely, completely different story. And so in this equation, you can basically take the UK out. They're now an island nation that have their own nuclear deterrence, but do not have the geopolitical power that Europe could have, the EU could have. And I was very happy to see France actually floating this idea this week, saying, hey, we might be willing to share our nuclear shield. Now, this, again, is not an easy process, because what would that look like? Of course, France would want to maintain control of its nuclear weapons. It's not going to give them to Poland and Germany and say, hey, here you have them. So France would still have the final say, but to be a proper deterrence, to be a proper shield, it needs to be clear to anyone on the outside that if you set one step into Poland, and I'm saying Poland obviously because of Ukraine and Russia, then automatically France will activate it. That is not an easy thing to actually establish in practice. But this is exactly the kind of conversations we need to have. This is absolutely what is needed. And again, I can't believe that I'm actually advocating for nuclear weapons. But, you know, I'm a changed man. But it is required in order to make this geopolitical shift that is fundamental.
So you basically need to extend, what was it, Article 42, I believe, right, of the European Union, right, the one about collective defense, basically the equivalent to NATO Article 5. You need to have an extension of this with nuclear weapons that is then signed, and you also have to then just, like, not just sign it, but you have to do the talk, right? You basically have to mention it every chance possible that, hey, anyone thinking about visiting Poland in a way that breaks sovereignty, please be advised that nuclear weapons will drop on your head.
Yeah, and have a very clear process of what it would look like, right? So again, I apologize for using the Russian boogeyman as the example here, because I have fought tooth and nail over, you know, this idea that Russia is about to invade the European Union. It's not going to happen. But let's, in this hypothetical scenario, imagine a Russian tank driving into Polish territory. Then there needs to be a very clear structure where immediately France says, Russia, you've got 24 hours to withdraw. After 24 hours, we start activating our nuclear weapons because Poland falls within our defense shield. And it has to be clear to everyone. It has to be open to anyone on the outside. France has to be able to commit to it. And Poland needs to be able to trust it. That is what needs to happen. Now, that seems easy if you put it like this, but in practice that requires a lot of talking, a lot of negotiating, a lot of formalizing of steps. And it would require a certain sacrifice in terms of the French, because they are actually committed to something that might not always be in their direct interest. But in from the bigger picture perspective, it is what is needed, even if you are the French president.
I almost envy international relations students at the moment who get to write essays about all of this, because I remember struggling once in a while to find a good topic. I think you cannot struggle at the moment.
Now, it's the best moment to be an international relations student. There are PhD papers waiting to be written on this kind of thing, Nobel Prizes to be won, well, Peace Prizes maybe. The world is in such flux that, and nobody knows what the future holds, that this is absolutely the best time to study these things. And answers, we're still looking for answers, so answers are there to be found, right? It is very clear, though, that this kind of manifesto that we are putting forward is one of the answers that's absolutely needed just from a European perspective. It is not particularly difficult to understand why what we're saying is important. It does require for people, and maybe even listeners of this podcast, to basically go past the emotional obstacles to all of this, right? And like I said, for me, it is kind of weird that I'm now on the record, on the internet forever, saying that we need to spend more on the defense and that we need to expand the nuclear shield. That is not me, but the world is kind of forcing us into this place. Not Russia itself, not the United States itself, just the dynamics of where we're heading in the 21st century.
Well, and point number 9, you are already on the record on the internet about this. And this is also something that I don't think anyone could have predicted when we recorded the first few episodes of this podcast. But point number 9 is to actively support Ukraine in the run-up to a ceasefire and peace negotiations, right?
Yeah, we have been quite consistently critical in this podcast about European and US support for Ukraine, not because Ukraine doesn't deserve to be supported, but because there was no objective, there was no success formula, right? You always, in international relations, you should only do something if you know what you're trying to achieve. And it seems these past 3 years that there was no actual understanding of what the West was trying to achieve. They weren't pushing for peace, they weren't pushing for a ceasefire, and as a result, just sending weapons and sending money to Ukraine without some kind of foreseeable outcome was a destructive exercise. And I think that a lot of the pain that Ukraine has been suffering from could have been avoided if the West had had a different approach. But now things have turned around, because it's very, very likely that there are going to have to be this year ceasefire and maybe even peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, because the White House has shifted its stance, has done a complete 180. And now Ukraine needs to be bolstered for those negotiations. It cannot be that Russia and the United States decide the fate of Ukraine. That would be terrible for Ukraine, and it would be terrible for Europe as a whole, especially from that bigger vision that we're trying to portray here. Europe needs to make clear that it is backing Ukraine in order for Ukraine to have some kind of fair shot at a peace deal that it is never going to be just, because the invasion of Russia into Ukraine was never just in to begin with. It's never going to be positive, but at least isn't as destructive as it otherwise would be. So for the first time in these years, I'm saying to Europeans, let the money and let the weapons flow to Ukraine. You need to make Ukraine strong in these negotiations, or at least stronger than it is right now. And I'm, again, very happy to see that even just symbolically, the European leaders, including Starmer from the UK, are falling over themselves to literally give Zelensky a hug, right? It's a symbolic thing that is then backed up by weapons and by money in order to signal both to the White House as well as to Moscow, to the Kremlin, that Ukraine is not alone. And that is absolutely essential. So just like defense spending before didn't have a purpose or a clear purpose, and now it does, so now it is legitimate, transform your military. Support for Ukraine didn't have a purpose before, now it does. Make sure that Ukraine stands strong in negotiations.
Baldur, you're doing something right now that not a lot of people are doing out there, is that when you propose things we need to do, you have a follow-up sentence explaining why. And that's something that's not really common in international relations, unfortunately.
And that's exactly the problem with international relations. People behave based on their emotional state of mind. They see an invasion of Russia and Ukraine, they get angry and they say, we need to support Ukraine, and they don't have an explanation of what they want to get out of it. This is one of the main issues that international relations face. And it's one of the main issues that why people like me earn a lot of money consulting clients, because clients need that therapy, right? They need to be, it needs to be clarified that that what they're actually doing is instinctive and it doesn't actually lead to the results you want to see happen.
And this is why we're now starting a little Twitter beef between you and another popular Dutch analyst. His name is Ivo Daalder. And there's a quote that we want to talk about because I think it does deliver some interesting insights. And I quote, "Under Vladimir Putin, Russia has embarked on a systematic challenge to the West. The goal is to weaken the bonds between Europe and the United States and among EU members, undermine NATO's solidarity, and strengthen Russia's strategic position in its immediate neighborhood and beyond." End quote.
Yeah, I don't know from which year this quote is. It's probably from a while back. Ivo Daalder, Dutch analyst who has been at the Brookings Institution for a long time and an important voice in US foreign policy. And this is exactly it. So to a certain extent, he is right in this, right? There's no doubt that when anyone, including us, say, hey, we should break up NATO, there needs to be a divorce, hopefully a respectful divorce between Europe and the United States, then Putin likes the sound of that. There's no doubt about that. Russia is happy with this. Yeah, so what? Okay, let Russia be happy with it. It is just a reality that we're facing. What happens with people like Daalder is that they are in this mindset, sort of Cold War mindset that automatically will always portray the world as the West versus Russia. There's always this existential war in their mind happening between the two. And that means that whenever Russia is happy, the West shouldn't be happy and vice versa. Right, so it's immediately a matter of we need to stay strong. The transatlantic alliance needs to survive because otherwise the enemy wins. Well, here's the thing: Russia is an enemy to Ukraine at the moment. Russia invaded Ukraine and hopefully will not have too successful a peace negotiation as a result. But to automatically, intuitively, emotionally, forever portray the world as one in which it is us versus them is incredibly damaging towards ourselves. And we cannot continue these kinds of vibes, if you like.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on what should the European Union do now following the events from last week. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western Bubble. That is it from my side. Baldur, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, I've been having sleepless nights because of the fact that this past week I've been advocating for greater defense spending and more weapons to Ukraine. And it makes me think of a very well-known, almost cliched quote by John Maynard Keynes. And it goes, when the facts change, excuse me, I'm sorry, Dario. When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?